A Professional Education Group Incorporated is pleased to present Persuasion in the Courtroom. This program was recorded before a live seminar audience and is accompanied by a manual which complements the course content. Joseph V. Guastafero is a highly acclaimed actor, director, CLE lecturer, and trial consultant. He is a faculty member for the National Institute of Trial Advocacy. And his presentations on the effective use of persuasion in the courtroom have won him the acclaim of lawyers throughout the country. Guastafero served as Associate Dean of DePaul Goodman School of Drama in Chicago. As a director, he has more than 40 fully mounted stage productions to his credit. He appears frequently in Chicago theater and has a host of television and advertising credits. We hope you enjoy this presentation of Persuasion in the Courtroom.
Thank you all for coming this morning. It's always very exciting to like spend 15 minutes before the program to walk around wondering what the heck you're going to say. You know, how are we going to get this ball in the air? How are we going to get it rolling? And standing up here and looking out at all of you who have journeyed forth this morning, I really appreciate you coming. I was just commenting to one of you that I know that feeling when you're sitting here and you've got 10,000 things stacked on the corner of your desk and you're wondering, why should I be away from the office and how far away is the nearest telephone because I've got to get there to check back in. I've been consulting on a trial up in Illinois for the last 10 days and the jury went out last night. And so I too want to get to that telephone and find out what's going on with that trial. So I share with you that split energy of wanting to get out there, but wanting to stay in and keep in touch with what's going on. The place I'd like to start this morning is talking briefly about a little book written by a man who's a creative consultant to a number of very powerful corporations. His name is Roger Von Ohk. Mr. Von Ohk has written a book called A Whack on the Side of the Head. And it's a delightful little paperback that the sequel is called A Kick in the Seat of the Pants. So you could tell that Mr. Von Ohk has got a sense of humor about his area of specialty, which is creatively approaching old procedures and old ways of doing things. And he gets people to look at the axioms, statements, mindsets, if you will, that prevent new thought. You know, it's never been done like that before, or you won't get away with that around here. And he says that in order to unlock those aphorisms, we need to administer a whack in the side of the head to shake up our thinking and to get a new approach, a new slant on the problems that we face. I worked at a Defender Institute up in Albany, New York last summer. And we had buttons made up that said, you can't do that in my jurisdiction, with the international no sign slashed through it. And it's sort of the feeling that whenever someone talks about trial practice or trial procedure, there's a certain amount of resistance that's going to be sitting out there. You know the judges that you're up against. You know the courtroom procedure that you're up against. And you're going to sit there and say, well, that's very interesting, Joe, but there's no way my judge is going to let me get away with that. And I have an interesting anecdote to tell you about that. Jim Jeans, who is an excellent trial lawyer and a great teacher who I work with in the Mastering the Craft program through the PEG group, tells a story about being a young lawyer back in the early 50s and going to one of the first CLE seminars up in Chicago. And the speaker was, as he puts it, a svelte Melvin Belli. And Mr. Belli was talking about final arguments. And he said to this group of young lawyers, one of the things that I'd love to have in the courtroom is a chalkboard. And then when I'm asking for damages, they write down the amount that I'm looking for. And I put it up there in big letters. And Jim reports the wave of reaction that had in the audience. Almost every one of the lawyers, to a person, said, a chalkboard? I wonder if my judge would even allow me to have one. And this is only in the 50s. Can you conceive of a courtroom nowadays? I mean, I've been in some where the chalkboard is built in. Can you conceive of a piece of demonstrative evidence as benign as a chalkboard being denied you? Yet 30 some odd years ago, that was an impossibility in some jurisdictions. So I feel two things about this little opening that I'm making here. One is that you should say about 3 times an hour for the rest of the day, I'll never get away with that in my courtroom. And I want you to say that. And two, I'd like you to remember the Melvin Belli story. And remember that those of you who are trying cases, those of you who are going into the courtroom, whether it's 3 times a year or 10 times a year, and really hammering on trial procedure, really forging the way, setting the style for what can be accepted and what can be used. In a sense, you're pushing the envelope, you know, to use that Chuck Yeager expression. You're finding out how to get the case to the jury and how to get the case in front of the triers of fact and out of the situation where it's mired down in legal ritual. Now, rituals are wonderful things because they make us feel like we belong, but they can become terribly deadly things when they just get locked up in convention and everything sort of becomes a pro forma way of doing things. I taught a seminar up in Seattle, and we were doing an exercise in the voir dire section, or voir dire section, however you pronounce it down here. And a young man came up to practice on the ladies and gentlemen that we brought in to play jurors that day. And he sat down at his counsel table and he started asking his questions. And he asked 5 questions of the first person on the panel. And then he moved over and he asked the same five questions of the second person on the panel. And by the time he got to the third person, this is the first exercise, and we were going to do this for 8 hours. I said to him, whoa, I'm bored already. I wonder how the jury feels. Why are you doing it that way? And why are you sitting down? Don't you think it would be nice if you stood up and talked to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury? And he said, gosh, I don't know. And I said, well, does your judge make you sit down? Is that the way the practice is done in your jurisdiction? He said, you know, I never ask. And I said, so you just came in and sat down. And as we, you know, I tried to do the Socratic method. I'm not very good at it, but we tried to go through and I asked him a bunch of questions. And what it came down to was, as a young lawyer, he came out of law school. He got his first case. He had to go to trial. He didn't know what the hell to do. So he went to the courthouse and he watched what everybody else did. And he started copying it. So he fit right into the ritual and never asked the question of, can I stand up when I address the ladies and gentlemen of the jury? He just sat down. So we sent him home. I got a letter from him after the seminar. He's doing his voir dire from on his feet now, and he likes it a lot better, you know? And we talked to him about the possibility of developing a number of questions so that each person on the panel doesn't get asked the same 5 questions. I said, you got to watch those. You know, you have, whenever we go through jury selection, I always watch out for the guy who shows up with his briefcase, you know, because he said to the folks at the office, I got called for jury duty. I'll go down there and take care of this tomorrow. And he's sitting at the back of the courtroom listening to the answers that you don't want so that when you ask him those same 5 questions, he can go off on you and get excluded. What can I do to get the hell out of here and get back to work is his attitude. So he's going to go to school on the questions that you're asking. So you need to have many ways to sort of come at the same point of view. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit on voir dire. The point I'm trying to make here early on is that there are lots of different approaches. And creativity in trial work is really something that we need to think about. Because our juries are getting somehow less educated, but more sophisticated in what it takes to keep them engaged during the trial. On the negative side, we have the 30-second news bite, which is about all that they can comprehend. On the negative side, we have an ever-spiraling downward approach to reading and comprehension that's being promulgated through the school systems. But on the positive side, we have people who are relatively sophisticated in keeping many story plots going together. We have people who are very conditioned towards advertising and very conditioned towards multi-image connecting, keeping a theme alive through short snippets of TV commercial type approaches towards their persuasion. So persuading that jury is a challenge, and it's not something that we can get at by droning on in a stentorian approach to the argument that we're presenting, you know, and just doing that sort of thing. And we still see a lot of that. But getting out there and approaching your trial differently. And the approach that I want to push here today, and the approach that I work for as a trial consultant, is the persuasion approach, which is jury-centered. Not the legal analysis approach, which is ritual-centered. Okay, and we'll be talking about all day long about how those two things trade off. The persuasion approach to a trial focuses on the jury and how things are going down with the jury. I get very distraught when I'm involved in a trial and I watch, or occasionally a lawyer will call me up and say, can you come, I'm doing this case today in federal court, can you come down and watch me? I'll pay you for your time. I really would like some feedback. And I go into a trial and I watch the two lawyers trying the case for each other. You know, there's an old, I've never been in the military, but there's an old military expression the paratroopers have. They say there are men who jump, and there are men who like to be near men who jumped. I think that there are, you know, lawyers who like to talk about great trial moves. And you watch them at trial, and it looks like they're working to build war stories for the cocktail hour so that they can sit down with another lawyer and say, did you see what I did to him on cross-examination? I made mush out of his testimony. Well, from a legal point of view, he may have, but the thing that he's not focusing on is that the jury missed it. From a legal point of view, he may have devastated the argument, but the impact of that devastating cross-examination never made it to the jury. They were somewhat befuddled. Why is he being so ornery? Why is he so ticked off? What's he yelling at now? And they don't get why you're at that point. By focusing on how things go down with the jury, you start to automatically make things jury-centered. And keeping them jury-centered is where the trial is won. I just told the same person in the back of the room, I didn't know I was going to mention this, but this seems like an opportune time to mention it. And this is not to grease my elbow, but it's an interesting insight into the need for a new approach. A year ago, we did this program in South Carolina or North Carolina or one of the Carolinas. I always get them confused. And on the way back on the plane, I was looking at the evaluation sheets. And there was one evaluation which was devastating. You know, and I'm just like all of you. You can get 1,000 great evaluations and you get one that's bad, and that's the only one you think about for weeks. And I was reading through this evaluation, and this young man said, this was terrible. It was a waste of my money. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not a lawyer. What's he telling us to do about trials and so on and yada, 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 yada. I mean, he was alleging that my eyes were brown for something other than genetic reasons, you know. He was devastating. And when we flipped the case over, the sheet over, there was the question, how long have you been in practice? And this complaining lawyer had been in practice 1 year. In the same batch, there was a Joe Guastafaro for president sort of evaluation. This is great. This is what we need. Forget about the lawyers. Let's talk about how it's going on with the jury. And it was glowing. Turned it over. How long have you been in practice? 26 years. Lawyers who are successful are lawyers who are always looking for the new spin. Lawyers who are really good at trial procedure are always looking for a new way to think about their trial. Lawyers who are not so successful are lawyers who kind of do it the same way each time. There's a lawyer up in Chicago who shall go nameless, who is a wonderful lawyer. If you analyze each of his skills, he's terrific. He has one flaw. He has somebody else prepare his case. So he's got this staff that does all of the interviewing and all of the deposition taking. And in the criminal matters, you know, all of the discovery gets filed and coded and da 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 da. And then he picks up the file and he goes into court and he tries the case. And he loses. Because he's got a way of trying a case and he tries to rely on his personal skills. And he doesn't get involved with the process of brainstorming, living with the case, following it through, jotting down things in the middle of the night. You know that kind of obsession that you get when you're at trial? Working on this case up in Illinois in the last week, I said to the attorney that I was working with, the only analogy that I can make between being on trial and being in a play is that everything else in your life sort of goes on hold. There's not a moment that you're not thinking about how can we get this in? How can we make this point? We didn't develop this. How can we rehabilitate that witness? What can we do? Should we bring in the investigator? And this is just going on. And I don't care what you get paid an hour, you can't get paid enough money for that kind of thinking. And I think that's exciting kind of thinking because it puts you on the cutting edge. I get concerned when I'm working with a lawyer who says, well, we had a good day, boom, closes the file, and he's done with it. Now, it seems to me that when you're at trial, there's that thing that's churning the whole time. And the best ideas come to you when you're least expecting it, it seems to me. Now, this great point we're going to develop in final argument, you know, came to me while I was at the health club on the Stairmaster, you know, sweating and schwitzing and going crazy, and I got it. We can make this point. So the creative approach to going out of trial is the approach that allows you to look at the old way of doing things in a creative way. Now, lawyers shy away from the word creative because they say, I'm not a creative person. Oh, I have no proclivities with creativity. Oh, you know, I went to school. And, you know, I'm not talking about making valentines, and I'm not talking about creativity in the sense of artwork. There are some of us who work in the arts who are not very good handicraft type people. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler. So I'm not talking about creativity in terms of arts and crafts. I'm talking about creativity in terms of thinking, about how you go about thinking about a problem. And this area of cognitive thought is becoming a real goldmine for clinical psychologists who are getting involved in trial work. And there's more and more articles being done all the time about how jury members process information and what their cognitive thinking patterns are like. I'd like to spend just a minute talking about hard thinking and soft thinking. Hard thinking. Hard thinking is cognitive thinking. Hard thinking is, well, let me say this up front. This is the way I distinguish between hard thinkers and soft thinkers. A hard thinker is a person who makes a list of things to get done and does them. A soft thinker is a person who makes a list of things to get done and then loses the list. I'm kind of ensconced in that category myself. Hard thinking is the kind of thinking that you were trained to do in law school. A plus B equals C. It's black and white. There are no ambiguities. Absolutes abound. You know, inconsistencies are weaknesses, and you learn to look for them, focus on them, and go for them. The hard thinking individual is sort of bottom line oriented, you know. Where do we have to go? Let's get there. Okay. The soft thinking individual is the individual who can live comfortably in the gray world, where there are no absolutes, where nothing is black and white, where there's lots of ambiguity, and there's lots of different ways of looking at something. The soft-thinking person is not very result-oriented, doesn't care about the bottom line. Now, what we're learning about these two phases of thought, and this sort of goes hand in hand with all of that right brain, left brain stuff that everybody's writing about lately. What we're learning about these two different kinds of thinking is that we need both. We can't just comfortably stay in one. Okay, if you're in the hard thinking phase of a project, and somebody involved with the project is a real soft thinker, you're going to feel like giving them a little poke in the head and saying, okay, let's stop that. We got to move on. And similarly, if you're involved in the soft thinking phase of a process and somebody is a hard thinker, they can squelch all of the initial ideas. There's that whole TV campaign for Hewlett-Packard, the what if. You know, the what if phase of problem solving is the soft phase. What if we did this? What if we did that? What if, what if, what if? And that's great. I call it free fall thinking. You just kind of think out loud. But sooner or later, you reach a point where if those thoughts and those ideas are going to be moved along, you've got to get hard thinking about it and you've got to shift gears. But if you do one sooner than if you use one way of thinking when you're in one phase of the problem or the inappropriate phase of the problem, your idea is not going to get anywhere. Well, let's talk about it in terms of a trial. I get very nervous when a lawyer calls me up and says, Joe, how'd you like to help me on this case? It's a straight leg off. You know, it's a straight slip and fall in the criminal matter. It's a straight misidentification. Ah, it's a rape case, straight consent. What that says to me is that the lawyer has applied his or her analytical way of thinking to the problem, has focused on the legal issues, has decided on the defense or the point of view to be taken throughout the trial, and is going to shortcut soft thinking and just get involved with what they need to prove the case. Okay? So it's a straight slip and fall. We're going to prove that negligence, blah, 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 blah. You get into that. And the definition of the case as a slip and fall dictates a whole series of procedures that sort of become inviolate. And everybody just starts down the path. What I suggest is that you spend a little bit more time in the soft thinking phase about the trial problem, so that you're brainstorming it. You're playing what if. You're saying, "What? Wait a minute, how did this really come about? What? Let's go back here a second." And you start putting it together in a way that leads you away from that leg off, leads you away from that slip and fall theory for a while. You may get back there, but on the way in the soft thinking phase, you're going to develop a lot of really neat information. You're going to develop a lot of really nice stuff that becomes grist for your mill in terms of the overall persuasion that you have to carry out with the jury. You know that the jury is going to be more interested in who that person was who fell. But what a lawyer will do all the time is they'll go through bang, 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 bang. You know, we'll have the investigator find out this, we'll have this, we'll do this, we'll do this. And then in final argument, they'll throw in something like, "Now let me tell you about Mrs. Guastafaro. She's a homemaker, she's got three small kids." And then you try to bring in the personalization in final argument. You know, that's the stuff that gets developed in the soft thinking phase, and that gets brought out in the trial very early on, so that when you mention it again in final argument, it's not the first time they're hearing about it. And it's part of a dovetailing, moving forward sort of approach to the whole trial. The brainstorming aspect of the trial is I think, absolutely crucial. And I think you need to think about brainstorming in a couple of ways. The first way is that there's no right or wrong answers. That you think about your client or your trial team and yourself sitting on opposite sides of a huge cauldron. And any idea that comes up gets pitched into the cauldron. The good ones will float to the top, the bad ones will precipitate out. But at that point, there's no judgment about which idea is good, about which idea is bad. You just start throwing it out. And you start thinking about the problem. I think it's a good idea to brainstorm with people who are not lawyers, because they're going to tell you about what's going on with the jury. Now, I was working on a case a while ago. It involved a churning problem. Someone from Payne Webber took this guy's money and just kept buying and selling and churning commissions for himself. So every time he bought and sold, he got a commission. And he ended up using up all of this guy's money. And there was a litigation about it. And I was talking about it to my wife, and she said, "Wait a minute. You can't tell me that this guy whose money was being used can amass the fortune that he's got and not know that this goes on. He's going to claim that this was going on behind his back? Come on." And it was a real common sense issue that we had to focus on and address in the trial. It had nothing to do with the law involved. It had nothing to do with, what the facts of, here's this common sense issue. Here's a millionaire who's made money buying and selling property, who's made commissions throughout his life, his adult life anyway, while he was amassing this fortune. And now he's going to stand up in front of a court and say, "This guy took my money and he used it and he churned up all of this profit for himself and I didn't know what was going on." Seems to me you got to deal with that. Because if you don't deal with it at trial, they're going to deal with it in the jury room. Somebody's going to scratch their head and say, "Wait a minute, this doesn't make sense." And so brainstorming and thinking out loud about those kinds of problems is real important. What it does from my point of view and where I get helpful in trials, at this point, is thinking about the ways to integrate all of the elements. Persuasion is the result of integration. It's not the coup d'etat at the end. It's not the brilliant final argument that persuades, but it's the little bitty steps that you take along the way to unfold the entire case. Persuasion is a result of integration. And I've got a couple of anecdotes that I'd like to share with you about how that point is true, or why that point is true. You know that book, In Search of Excellence, that Tom Peters wrote? I saw a videotape of Mr. Peters delivering a lecture. And in that lecture, he talks about doing some consulting work with the CEO, president of Midway Airlines. And they're talking about how to provide a feeling of ownership throughout the entire organization, from the executives right on down to the guy who handles the baggage or greases the lugs on the landing mechanism of the airplane. And the president of Midway Airlines said, there may be a difference between president and CEO, but you know who I'm talking about, that dude who's up there. He said to the consultant, if we don't clean the coffee rings on the trays, the passengers suspect us of not doing our engine maintenance. And there's an idea of how the persuasion, convincing the passengers that they're in good hands, is reflected in something as mundane as passing a handy wipe over the serving tray in the passenger compartment. If you see sloppiness at that point, you sit there and say, what's the guy who's got real responsibility thinking about? When you're at trial, all of those little details that you let go are going to pop up and detract from your overall persuasiveness. See, we have this notion somewhere in our minds that you use persuasion when you're trying to get somebody to do something against their will, and that's not true. Because that makes us think about persuasion as manipulation. And it's not manipulation. It's a very thought-provoking, evoking process that both people enter into. Think about this commercial. I know you've seen it. Opening shot is a baseball player and an umpire. The baseball player is a white guy. He's a catcher. The umpire is a black guy. And they're standing at home plate, and they're sort of dangling their face masks, and they're looking out towards the outfield, and they're joking with each other. They're laughing, and they're nodding their head. And then they cut to the outfield. The voiceover is, in the minors, you called them all, right? And you see these two guys joking, and it's not very serious. It's the minors. And then they cut to the outfield, and there's this beautiful Labrador, Golden Lab, running after a Frisbee, frolicking in the outfield. No, minor leagues, not serious baseball. The next shot is the umpire in the locker room changing his clothes, and the locker room, they use these smoke machines in TV commercials so that the background sort of gets misty and warm and the lights and the photography look real terrific. Smoke makes everything look great in photography. And the guy is sitting there. You can almost see the tobacco stains on the floor in this locker room. And an old geezer comes walking down the aisles, and he hands the guy a telegram. And the umpire opens the telegram. And he looks at it and he says, thanks, Pop. Now, come on. Here's a locker room, baseball, All-American. And the guy's name is Pop. Already they're hooking us into the warmth of this experience. And the commercial is about 2 seconds old. Then the next shot is the guy on the telephone. And he says, his line is, babe, I got the call. Not, I got a promotion, honey. It's, babe, I got the call. We enter into this man's world. We know what kind of person. He calls his wife, babe. Isn't that nice? It's a real endearing sort of thing, and she's delighted that he got a promotion, but it's not some yuppie conversation about advancement in the corporate ladder. It's, babe, I got the call, right? And we have a cut. Bang. I get goosebumps every time I go to a night baseball game because it's just exciting. And the cut is of this very good-looking black man pulling on his baseball hat, his head framed against a bank of stadium lights, pulling down his hat, and he trots out onto the field. Cut to the stands, and here's this very attractive, but not too sexy. Women can't be too sexy, especially black women on television. She's holding a sign that says, I love the ump. So now we know that in this strange environment, this guy has got two fans, the lady holding the sign and us. Right? We're with him. He trots out onto the field. Now, everything is going along too smoothly. And in order to give it more credibility, we have to have a little bit of conflict. So we cut to the opposing dugout. Dun, dun, dun. There's the opposing manager, hands in his back pocket, big beer belly sticking out over the top of his spandex waistband on his pants. Takes a spit of his chaw tobacco. Who's the new guy? He says. Now we have problems. This guy is a redneck. He's a beer drinking redneck. And he's spitting on the ground saying, who's the new guy? So we've got the good forces set up against the evil forces. Story proceeds. We're now 5 seconds into a 30-second commercial, right? The story proceeds. We're already aligned. We know who we're in favor of, right? This guy has come up through the minors. He's paid his dues. He's ready for the step. okay? Close play at third base. The camera records the irony of the situation. Irony is when the audience knows something that the people in the play or movie don't know, okay? So we see the slide, we see the hand, we see the ball in the glove come down, tag the runner out. He's clearly out. We know it. The ump knows it. The ump gives his call, he says. But it's close enough for our manager to get all turned up. He comes charging out of the dugout, and he confronts our new umpire. Uh-oh, what's going to happen? The new guy meets the old Saul. You know, we got a problem here. The innuendo, of course, is all the racial tension that goes on underneath that, and these two guys stand face to face, and they start jawing at each other. Wonderful rules in baseball. You can't touch, you know, so you kick dirt on each other, and you get real close, and you turn the peak of your hat around, but you never touch, right? These two guys are talking and yelling and talking and yelling and talking and yelling, and finally, our hero, the umpire, adjusts his cap and walks away. Manager thrusts his hands into his back pocket, spits, and heads back into the dugout. Okay. So what do we have at this point? We're about 7 seconds into the commercial now. What do we have at this point? We have our guy who we've been identifying with throughout the history of his life. We have our guy, okay, standing by his conviction. He did the right thing, and he's going to stick to it, and God, we love him. You know, he's right. And we're going to stick with him. Cut to the bar after the game. Okay? Now, the redneck manager is over here at the bar looking like somebody from Reagan's cabinet. And the black man is over here looking like something out of an Afro-Sheen commercial. You know, his hair is oiled and he's looking terrific, really closely shaved. His wife is coiffed just perfectly. They look like the ideal couple. They look like businessmen. The waitress comes over, two Budweisers on the tray, offers the Budweiser to the umpire. He picks it up, shoot across the room to the redneck manager. They toast each other, and they have a beer. Right? Not only do you want the Budweiser, you want that to happen in your life. Right? You want to be acknowledged for your hard work. You want to be promoted because you're good at what you do. You want to have that one situation which convinces the world that you are a stand-up guy and you will stand by your convictions. And even if you anger somebody, it will pay off because in his heart, he knows that you're right and he won't hold your convictions against you, and then you get rewarded. And the reward in this case, the 6-ounce bottle of Bud, you know, but I guess they're bigger than that. What's it, 9 ounces? You know, but that's the reward. So what's the message? What's the persuasion? The persuasion is work hard, stick to your guns, hold to your conviction, be of good values, and you get the reward in the end. That's the theme of that commercial. 30 seconds tells us an entire life story of that man, his family, and their success and reward. We are very attuned to persuasion, and we enjoy it when it happens to us in those kinds of increments. It happens subliminally. We buy into it. We get emotionally involved with it. We get moved by it. And then we see the happy resolution. So we go with it. You know? Persuasion is not something that you whap on somebody at the end. It's something that you build to and unfold throughout the entire presentation. Your trial, from the moment you pick up the file folder, is the beginning of a persuasion process. that moves right on through final argument. A while back, I directed a play called The Rainmaker. Great play. It was so great that the poor author has never been able to write another successful play. I mean, he got a lot of mileage out of this baby. And the play has to do with ranchers somewhere in Oklahoma. The geography is nebulous, so we don't really know exactly where. But there's a drought. And there's language in the play that says these people are losing 100 head of cattle a day because of this horrible drought. You know, it's a big ranch. If they can afford to lose that many cows, that's a big ranch. And the play, which I won an award for, you know, was a play. I started thinking about what do we want to convince the jury, the audience of, about this play? And I started reading through the scenes, and it dawned on me that the play had nothing to do with conflict. The play had everything to do with love. The main story was how Lizzie, the good-hearted but spinsterish daughter, you know, wants to find a husband. And Starbuck, the rainmaker, blows into town, sweeps her off his feet. She has a confrontation with him, but they end up in love at the end of the play. So one storyline is her falling in love. Another storyline is the father and his relationship with his two sons and how much love he feels for them, but how his inability to tell them about it. Another storyline is the oldest brother and his relationship to his younger brother, wanting to be a good role model, how much love he feels for the kid brother, but being unable to talk about it. So the whole play, from top to bottom, is this story about how people want to get and keep a loving relationship, but they don't know how. And they're thwarted by the old way of doing things, fathers don't do this and that and the other thing. So when I sat down to work with the designers, you know, they say, okay, Joe, what do you want the play to look like? I say, I got real vague with them. I said, I want it to look like love. Great. What does love look like? I said, you tell me what love looks like. Design a kitchen for me in that ranch house that exudes love. Okay. He went away to do some sketching. The costumer said, what do you want the costume to look like? I want the costumes to exude love. Don't be crazy. What do you want the costumes to look like? Love. I want the jeans that the cowboys to wear look like the jeans that people who love their work wear. I want the shoes to be worn in a certain way. I want all of the clothing to have sweat and wear marks on it. I want it to look like these people love what they've chosen to do. What do you want the lighting to look like? I want it to look like love. How does lighting look like love? I don't know. Pick a color. Let's work on tinting the gels. Let's work on the progression in the light. The whole play takes place from morning to night. Let's work on a progression in the lighting cues that goes from a beautiful Oklahoma sunrise to a spectacular night with a full moon and stars. Those elements are persuasive. We got down to designing the poster to look like love. It was a piece of aluminum. Aluminum foil, a real shiny cloth, then overlaid was red, and we cut out the red so that the silver would shine through. It was a huge cloud, and it was raining hard, you know, and it said, The Rainmaker. Anybody who saw that poster in the subway knew that that play was about something to do with boom, 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 boom. They walked in, I had a guy who played harp come and sit through rehearsals and improvise music to the rehearsal that was going on. And we recorded his music, and that was playing when the audience walked in. We costumed the ticket takers to look like ranch hands. We threw hay in the audience. We, you know, every little element went into setting the stage for this theme of familial love that we wanted to persuade our jury to focus on. We didn't end up at the last scene in which Lizzie falls in love, right? We started out with, what does she wear in the morning? How does she cook that breakfast? And all of the elements became integrated moving forward. In a production of Hello, Dolly! That I designed the costumes for, you know, there's a famous scene. Dolly's back in town. Dolly comes into the restaurant. We color coordinated the whole scene so that Dolly's dress, the colors of her costume, were picked up in the napkin and the drapery. When she walked into that room, what we were saying to our audience was, she belongs here. She fits in a visual sense, in an emotional sense, in a psychological sense. And then when they say, Dolly's back in town, it's right there. It makes sense because everything around it makes sense. You see, persuasion happens incrementally over time, and you build towards it. Let's talk about what moment that trial you think you need to be most persuasive. And I'm not going to fool you on this. I don't think that there's any one element of the trial that's more persuasive than any other element of the trial. I think you've got to be persuasive throughout. But you'll hear some people say, oh, voir dire is the time. Boy, if you're not persuasive in voir dire, if you really don't make a good impression, the trial is lost. Other people will say, opening statement. Opening statement, and they'll cite that, was it Zeiss study, a guy up at the University of Chicago, who says that 85% of the juries make up their minds after opening statement. You know, there's been some dispute about whether that's true or not, and depending upon who you listen to, Professor Zeiss has backed off that assertion to some extent. Other people say, particularly defense lawyers, we'll say cross-examination, boy, that's the time when I really get them. You know? And then other people will say, well, final argument, boy. Well, let's think about it, you know. I think that there are certain windows of opportunity to take a latter part of the 20th century phrase, huh? Window of opportunity, straight out of all the marketing management for success books. I think that there's one window that occurs the first moment you stand up before the jury to begin selecting the jury panel. I think there's another window that occurs during and shortly after opening statements. And I think that there's another window at the moment the plaintiff rests or the state rests. And I think those three places are propitious in terms of having high impact with the jury, you know? And you've got to come out at those moments with a plan that you're advancing, with a theme or with a theory. And how do we get at that? People call me up and they'll say, you'd like to get involved in this trial? We really need you to help us develop some colorful analogy. Great. You know, we really like you to help us, you know, what I get it when I, you know, I always sort of blow their minds because when I first come in, I'll say, okay, what do you want to argue? What points do you want to argue? What do you want to say in final argument? Now, what instructions do you need to write to get to be able to say this? And as you start working on the instructions, you start thinking about the motions that you need to file to keep certain evidence out. So you're working at the end of the trial to tell you what to do at the beginning of the trial. And your motion practice for a trial lawyer, motion practice to me is becoming it. You really have to know how to do motions. Motions can change the entire shape of what the jury is looking at. You know, you've got to be able to limit, to control, to block things, to keep things out, to get things in, so that you know where it's going from Jump Street. You know from the get-go where you want to end up. And then when you start thinking about what you're going to argue and how that final argument is going to take shape, you work backwards to cross-examination and say, what points do I need to score in cross so that I could add them up in final argument? And then once you've got the cross in shape, you know, you can start to think backwards further towards the kinds of issues that you're going to bring up during your trial that you better voir dire on. that you better get out in front of the jury from Jump Street. So, you know, where do you begin? I think you begin at the end and you work backwards. You know, what's the overall impact that we want to have? Our theory of the case is, and I usually ask the lawyers to say, to finish this sentence. This is a case about. And when they can finish that sentence, you know, then we're ready to start honing it in on a theme. This is a case about what? And you get 25 words or less, and it really boils it down. And you don't get all of the parentheticals, and you don't get all of the qualifiers, and you don't get all of the legal language. You get what the case is about, and that's what you start working from. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't work, I mean, sometimes in a criminal matter, what I'll do is I'll say, you've got 2 minutes to tell me why your guy shouldn't go to jail. Give me a 2-minute final argument. And generally, in 2 minutes, the lawyer gets right to the heart of the case. The issues that are favorable, the issues that are harmful, what we got to deal with, you know, bang, you're right there. Then you say, okay, now we're starting to develop a theory. Why is the theory so important? The theory gives you purpose. It's just like my reading the play and saying, this play is a play about love. Because now we can start to investigate and explore with the theme in mind. And as we begin to investigate and explore with that theme in mind, we'll be able to come up against the issues in the case that I call rivets. Okay? You're starting out, you've got this theory, you're investigating with purpose, you're going along, you're trying to prove something, and you run right smack dab into something. A knot in the wood, if you will. Your saw is not going to get through this. So you pull it out, you cut a new kerf, you drop over a couple of lines, and you start on a new theory. But by thinking through the theory of your case, you start to anticipate what you're going to run into. You start anticipating the facts that you need to nullify, to get around, to use to your own advantage, convert them into pluses. And you're thinking through your theory of the case. Now, I'm going to talk about some cases that I've worked on just to show you what I mean. I'm not trying to grease my elbow, and I'm not trying to welcome myself into the fraternity of lawyers. I mean, you've heard of lawyers who are frustrated actors. It's true. I'm an actor who's a frustrated lawyer. I would really love to try a case. And when I talk about these cases that I've worked on, I don't want you to hear me, although my ego will cause me to say, we worked on this and our guy did. You know, the lawyers tried the case, and I'm envious of them for that privilege to get up and argue a case. But in brainstorming some theories, I worked on a case in Arizona where the defendant was the Amoco Oil Company. And in that litigation, they had put together a very complicated leasing arrangement with hundreds of ranchers and millions of acres. The deal was to siphon off CO2 gas from these huge cavities under the range. And Amoco was into a very complicated leasing arrangement in this area called the Bravo Dome. You may have heard of it being down as far as country. One family wanted to pull out of this leasing arrangement, which would make the whole deal very vulnerable to collapse then. And the family who wanted to get out of the arrangement was alleging that Amoco was not paying them a fair price for the carbon dioxide that they were funneling off these caverns underneath the land. The case was 9 years old. And there were literally rooms full of geological and engineering reports. Xerox paper boxes filled with map after map and seismographic information and the rate of tilt in the cavern, so that the volume at this end and the gas at this end. It's like, oh my God, you know. When I went to meet with the lawyers, the firm who was defending the oil company, one of my first questions, one of my first problems was that in the 60s, I wore my hair when I had it in a ponytail, and I was very much aligned against these multinational companies. You know, I was what you would call a hippie. Sorry, it's true. You know? And I sat down with these representatives from this company and said, how am I going to believe that this big, big company is not, in fact, ripping off this little rancher? Everybody got defensive. Everybody got nuts. And they proceeded to give me one of the most terrific opening statements. We're not doing that because bang, 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 and we went through it. And this is a bang, 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 we went through it, you know? And I'm sitting there saying, this is a dynamite opening statement. What the hell are they doing with all of those seismographic reports? This is what the jury wants to know about. You know? We took it and we took those ideas and we worked on them. And I'd go back to my hotel room and say, okay, what are we going to do with all these ideas? Finally, we came up with the theme was greed. Now, when you're Amoco Oil, you're very reluctant to call anybody greedy, right? The word is not one that you want to put out in the universe for people to consider. So how do we get at the notion? How do we get at the concept without ever using the word? What we hit on was the theme, something more. Now they want something more. And we started talking about this family that got involved with this deal and how the deal was terrific until they wanted something more. And we started talking about how much money this family was going to make if they stayed in the deal as it was written with no improvements. Over a 45-year span of time, they would make $50 million. But now they want something more. Get it? The theme of greed starts getting insinuated about every four paragraphs in the opening statement. And we started showing how the deal was good, that Amoco was in fact honorable, that Amoco was in fact sticking to the arrangement as it was written, and everybody was profiting. This family now wants something more. They see a company with a deep pocket and they say, let's jump in. You know, the theme needs to be introduced early. The theory of the case needs to unfold around that theme, and the theme gets reinforced in various ways throughout. A few years back, I worked on a case with a group of two lawyers, one from Denver and one from Southern Indiana, who were representing 16 women against the G.D. Searle Company and the IUD action. And the Searle Company, who, you know, has all the resources in the world. I mean, think of everything that's got NutraSweet in it. They had a team of doctors that looked like they were from central casting. You know, Marcus Welby should look as good as the doctors who would take the stand and deliver what I think is bogus scientific evidence about why these women ended up having this incredible surgery and horrible diseases as a result of this IUD. No. And we start, you know, how are we going to countermand this? How are we going to go after their doctors? You know, I didn't know very much about IUD, so I started doing some research. And I found, you know, back when they had caravans, they used to, if the camels got pregnant on a caravan, they couldn't carry as much cargo. So the camel drivers would falsely induce a pregnancy so that the camel couldn't conceive, and therefore she was able to carry her weight. And I developed this theme of making profit off women's bodies, you know, and we started looking at the emotional issues that were around it. All of this information had come out about birth control pills and how harmful they were. And there were millions of people, millions of women who, you know, had developed a lifestyle, you know, where they needed birth control. And now their source of birth control was taken away. This incredible market said, what can we use now? And there was the G.D. Searle company to make use of and exploit the Copper 7 IUD. We developed that as a theme throughout. You know, we didn't win anything in this case. I mean, one of our women, one of the plaintiffs, was a judge. A judge. And we couldn't even get, this woman had a total hysterectomy as a result of the diseases that she got from the IUD. Anybody in the room have an IUD? Am I scaring the heck out of you? This woman, even though she was a judge, could not get the jury to disallow the company's doctors who said that the diseases were the result of promiscuity and not the result of this implement. Here's a judge. I mean, we're talking about a mindset here that was just impossible to prove. Like I say, we didn't win anything, but the result of that trial was that they stopped making the Copper 7 IUD. So we had this sort of moral victory, you know. But there was a very charged theme. There was a very strong emotional issue that was not going to be introduced in the case because everybody wanted to have a battle of the experts. Everybody wanted our doctors to talk against their doctors. And that went on. Just like in the Amoco case, the engineers got to get up and do their rap about how deep the cavern was. You know, that's going to happen. But as long as the jury has an emotional theme that they can keep coming back to, as long as they have a theory that is common sense to them, they can start hooking into it. You know? In a medical malpractice case, a guy in Chicago went to the hospital to have his wisdom teeth taken out, and he bled to death and died. And when I read the facts in this case, I stood there for 20 minutes going, wait a minute. This is 1987, in the most technologically advanced country in the world, a man bleeds to death having his wisdom teeth taken out? It's absurd. How did that happen? You know, and we'd go through some of the facts of the case, and I would say, but the guy died. But I don't care how negligent he was. I don't care if he had impacted teeth. I don't care if he had periodontal disease. You don't die from that. You go get it fixed. And that's what he was trying to do, and he bled to death. Oh, my God, you know. And we developed this wonderful case, which got settled. The family got nervous, and we never went to trial on it. But we had this wonderful theme and theory going about how this man didn't do a darn thing wrong. You know, this man relied on his doctors, took one doctor's recommendation to another doctor, and went in to have his wisdom teeth removed. What could be more natural? And he bled to death. Oh my God. You know? And we went after it that way. The themes give the jury something to hang on to, something to make sense out of. And you really need to spend a little time thinking about that and thinking about how it goes on. Now, don't misunderstand me. You're not going to win a case unless you know the law. Unless you know how to get what you need into proof, you've got to know how to do evidence, and you got to know trial procedure. Law, proof, and procedure. You're not going to win if you don't know those things. But once you do, and you've got that in your hip pocket, let's talk about how the case gets tried. To quote Jim Jeans again, Jim Jeans says, at the basis of every trial is a human drama that lawyers try to reduce to a list of facts. And what we need to present to the jury is the human drama. I don't care if it's a patent issue where somebody stole somebody's patent for a screw design. There's a man who's got something invested in that, and he's going through some kind of angst about it. With big corporate clients, if you're on the defense side, finding the way to personalize them takes a little bit more soft thinking than you're used to doing.
This is the end of tape one. The program continues on tape two.